For Politico, I'm Ryan Heath, and this is Global Insider. There's been a lot of congratulations in the political class on both sides of the Atlantic about how quickly democracies have moved to cut off oxygen to the Russian economy and ultimately the country's war machine in light of its invasion of Ukraine. They have moved at lightning speed. As long as you overlook how little was done in the previous 8 years that Russia has been occupying parts of Ukraine. And as Western powers consider their next moves, it's also clear that the burdens of supporting Ukraine are not split evenly. It's relatively easy for the US to say that it will ban Russian oil and gas, for example, because America doesn't depend on it as much as Europe does. It's the EU, not Britain or Canada or the US, that now has 3 million additional refugees on its territory in just 3 weeks. To work through those knotty issues, Maros Šefčovič, Vice President of the European Commission, joins the podcast this week. He's serving his fourth term as a European Commissioner in Brussels, which is a post-Cold War record amongst commissioners, and we spoke around the conference table shared by the EU's 28 ambassadors in Washington. Mr. Vice President, thank you. You've come here to Washington to build transatlantic partnerships, to defend Ukraine, to defend democracy, and to reduce dependence on Russia and China. Where does that effort stand?
We had a very good discussion about setting up the Transatlantic Alliance for foresight and horizon scanning, which I think is very important. And indeed, it of course happens on the background of this ruthless, senseless war in Ukraine, which I think really re-energized our transatlantic bonds. I think we just have to be honest about it. Our dependency in this case, mostly on China and China enterprises, is quite significant. And we really have to work together to develop this new industry of getting raw materials, processing them, refining them, but of course, and what is our strength, recycling them. Talking about windmills, photovoltaic panels, batteries, of course, or microchips. We simply need to put our act together and where and when possible to work as a partners, because all these projects require quite heavy capex, initial investment. There is a lead time.
So the point there I am taking to be that we need to unwind dependence on China now, to avoid repeating the situation that the West finds itself in with Russia today.
Absolutely. And we cannot build a Europe which will be green and digital without being resilient. And that resilience means to be really much stronger in getting the important critical raw materials and to tackle these dependencies. We have, for example, enough lithium, but we do not have the refining capacities. We need to work very hard with our public to increase the public acceptance. Mm-hmm. We have to have a good answers for the worries they have, very much linked with the past mining projects, but very often the big businesses just left the mess behind, destroyed landscape, and simply you never heard of them. And of course, they never shared any profits with the local community. So therefore, what we discussed also with the Department of State is that we have to develop some kind of new sustainable principles for sustainable mining. If you look at young generation, if they want to have electric vehicle, they want to have the whole story green. Not only that they are not emitting emissions, but what is the carbon footprint of the battery, where the raw materials came from, what would be the recycling of all the parts of the car in the future. And therefore, I think here the EU-US cooperation on setting preferably global standards, I think would be very, very important.
You've worked for years now to get European national governments to build more LNG gas terminals for imports to come in by ship. Germany's committed to build another 2 terminals in light of the war in Ukraine. So what matters most now in getting those ready, getting the gas into Europe quicker?
What is, of course, very important is a political signal. We do not want to finance a regime which is attacking the peaceful neighbors and, of course, threatening all of us in the EU. So it was a very bold political decision. It will be quite a challenge. I think that our American partners, they understand it and they are, I would say, full of appreciation that we do it despite, I would say, this quite a difference in energy prices mm-hmm. between the US and yeah. in the EU. But there is a strong political resolve and gas operators, they have to learn how to trade in all directions, mm-hmm. not only from east to west, but also from west to east, from yeah. north to south, from south to north, and really have this European perspective.
So on one hand, you need to keep the lights on and it's still cold in Europe. On the other hand, and I think this is what's a bit hard for some Americans to process, is they see that Europe still buys something like $600 or $700 million a day of gas and oil from Russia through pipelines like Nord Stream 1, which kept operating this whole time. So you have people like the Ukraine sanction envoy saying you have to stop these imports, otherwise you keep funding the war in Russia. And then people need to stay warm in Europe. So how do you go about balancing those interests? And how quickly can you turn off some of this Russian gas and oil, you know, as it gets warmer?
I think that when you look through the debate and discussion of the European heads of states and government in Versailles just last week, the ambition is super high to just reduce these dependencies by 2/3 and to do as much as possible already this year. So, I mean, we are now already starting to buy the gas for, I would say, making sure that our gas storages would be filled by 90% before the next winter starts. And we already are sending messages to all potential partners, including to U.S. companies, that we would need more, that we are ready to work with you, and we will be as fast as it would be, I would say, technologically possible to supply that LNG to Europe. We are also working closely with Azerbaijan to boost their capacities, prospecting the possible supplies from North Africa. We also have Norwegian minister who was also telling us that they are looking what they can do more in existing fields or what would be the potential future fields output. But of course, they need to know how much gas we would need, what would be the time frame.
Okay, sounds good. But on the sanctions, are they enough? Like, we know they're massive, but are they enough to actually stop Russia?
I think we have shown enormous partnership and leadership on the way how we adopted the sanctions. And I think also here in the States, we got a lot of credit that we've been really leading this effort, because our commercial relationship with Russia, our financial relationship was much bigger than with the States. So to go and decide on freezing out the assets of Central Bank of Russia, delist the companies, and simply really be bold enough to create such an impactful damage to the Russian economy within 2 weeks.
It seems that there are actually some technical issues, in the sense of, if some of the gas that would be an alternative to Russia has to arrive by ship, you know, it can't, a ship can't move faster than it can move. So it feels like that is sort of months rather than weeks away. Is that kind of a fair assessment, that you can't just flick a switch and get a lot of this gas tomorrow?
Oh, you're right. It's much more complicated than that, because I mean, we are on a very tight gas market right now. I mean, I have to say that again, thanks to the good cooperation with the US, but also with our partners in Japan and South Korea. I mean, there was a lot of swap operation taking place during, especially the December and January, just to make sure they would have enough gas to make it until the end of the winter. So it's definitely not easy solution. I think we have to do everything together to work on the Green Deal, and at the same time to look for reliable, fair partners for LNG to simply reduce the dependency on Russia, and of course, reduce the income they get from the sale of hydrocarbons to Europe.
You were talking about the Norwegian example and them wanting to know how much you might need. Is some of this about using the EU's collective resources to go and make advanced purchases of the gas to make sure that it actually turns up?
Yeah, actually, the idea, which was already for some time on the table, is what we can do better in the way of coordination, the common purchase of gas. I mean, to learn a bit from our common procurement of vaccines. And I think now, because we really go through this transformational moment in Europe and in the world, I mean, this is really the idea we have to develop further, to simply show the purchasing power of Europe, to see the financial muscle. We have to show that this demand is there. Clearly, the Commission will have huge responsibility of coordinating these efforts of member states, of the key gas and energy companies, because I think we have to be really in sync and to cooperate well in this matter.
And it feels like there is a new enthusiasm, maybe not for federal EU activity in general, but certainly on everything that relates to Ukraine. We see the Central and Eastern European governments, who are sometimes reluctant to sign on to what they think are Brussels initiatives. It feels like there is now more support for this level of cooperation and this umbrella support that the EU can give to its members.
Indeed, it's unprecedented. And this is very often not institutional. These are the people opening their houses, their apartments. Schools are organizing second shifts for Ukrainian children. Wow. They are organizing kind of recruitment of even not professional teachers, but Ukrainians who came as a refugee so we can keep the kids in school and at least reduce the trauma a little bit by introducing the rhythm they've been used to, that you wake up, you go to school, you learn in your own language, because I think this is so important. And also the fact that Commission in this respect acted very quickly with financial support, with material support. And it comes very natural that, for example, if you are talking about sanctions, because of course there need to be a political will, but there is enormous technical detail you have to master on all these measures. It's enormous technical detail just to, you know, the issue of airlines, leasing of the planes, of course, all this financial aspect of the sanctions, it requires enormous, enormous expertise. And here the fact that Commission could have acted with that expertise on behalf of all EU member states, made everything much faster, well organized. And therefore, I think also we got a lot of credit from our American partners that it was done in such a professional way.
Another very complex topic is Ukraine joining the EU as a member. And I watched the debate here in America, and it's informed by a lot of goodwill. They think the EU is good. They think Ukraine would benefit from being in the EU. Let's make it happen. And then I'm on Twitter saying, hang on, actually, it's more complicated than that. It takes years. You know, some of these countries that joined 20 years ago, they spent 10 years changing their systems to integrate. I thought maybe you could tell a bit of your personal experience of integrating your home country, Slovakia, into the EU, and why it's not just one vote at one summit that makes it happen.
I think what is very important right now is that we are really, as I said, living the historic moment, and it's time for very clear signal, for very clear messaging. And I think that nobody doubts that after all these sacrifices for European values, for democracy, for freedom, that Ukrainians are definitely part of the European family, and that we would like to have them in our family as soon as possible. And I think that's what they have to know. The people who are going through this toughest moment in their lives, I think they should know about it. They should hear it. And at the same time, as you said, for the country to be happy in the EU, the country and the EU have to be also very well prepared for making the membership a success. And therefore, now I think we really have to focus all our efforts on stopping the war. And I hope that it happens sooner than later. Then we need to focus on all our energy to rebuild the Ukraine into a prosperous, democratic country. Yesterday, I had excellent discussion in that regard with my former colleague, Kristalina Georgieva, because it's quite clear we would need to brainstorm, to think together, what can we do to build these destroyed houses, apartments for the people so they could come back? How to rebuild infrastructure? What we would need to do from, let's say, the financial perspective to give the investors confidence to go and invest in Ukraine.
I was going to suggest it feels like a geopolitical moment where the EU could say, Marshall Plan, EU style, we're taking the lead, but we mobilize the entire democratic world to do this. But I didn't think through the aspect of the modernization will actually make Ukraine a better member.
Yeah, because I mean, it's a bit based on the experience, be it, let's say, from the accession of my country, Slovakia, to the EU. We are kind of working, I would say, in the new framework. You are using the most modern legislation. There are new requirements you have to respect. So it brings you to the totally different level. There are different expectations from the civil service and so on and so forth. They are clearly Europeans by heart, by nature. And we just should help them to accelerate the transformation by rebuilding new Ukraine. But first thing first, we need to do now everything possible to stop the war.
I fully agree with you that you have to stop the war first. But the Slovak prime minister had what I thought was a very good sort of idea on symbols, where he said, okay, it might not have legal meaning, but you make Ukraine understand they're a candidate plus. You invite them to sit in at some of the summit meetings. You get the refinancing, rebuilding plan going. So you don't give away membership until people meet certain standards, but you show everyone in front of cameras, not just in words, hey, you're part of the family.
I think that as we see right now, and I think here President Zelensky deserves enormous credit to be so open and so strong in presenting the Ukrainian case. I was in the European Parliament when he made his speech. It was 8 minutes. Mm-hmm. It was one of the most emotional debates I attended. I was really very honored that I I could be there until the end and close this debate off, because I mean that this is once in a lifetime situation. And I think that his words resonated very strongly. And once, hopefully, these military hostilities are over, I'm sure that we will be very accommodating and creative on making sure that Ukrainians, but also other countries in distress, would be welcome to attend politically important meetings to discuss with us. Because I think that, indeed, after this, I fully understand Georgia and Moldova, that they are even more worried than they've been before. I mean, if you listen and follow the debate of Russian pundits on the TV, or what was said somehow to questioning everything what happened after 1997. So, I mean, that's the question where all Central and Eastern Europe, I mean, should take a note that we are not talking about Donetsk, Lugansk, Ukraine. We are talking about the complete, you know, reset of the peaceful world order, which was many, many difficulties and challenges built up since Second World War. So, I mean, we should all be on alert and be very united and very clear that we stand up to somebody who wants to push us around.
Now, I'm so excited we got through this whole interview. And I never asked you about Brexit. But it wouldn't be your job if you got to do a whole interview without talking about Brexit. People here worry very much about the Northern Ireland border. I also think, separate from that, that the Ukraine crisis is a reminder that the EU and UK have a lot more in common than some people want to acknowledge. Where do we stand on the border arrangements in Northern Ireland? Have people been asking you about it during this trip?
I think what is very important to say that also this crisis clearly demonstrated that how much we have in common with the UK, that we are staunch allies, we are eternal neighbors, and that when it comes to the difficult matters, we are excellent, excellent partners. And I think it was very important and very symbolic that my counterpart, Foreign Secretary Truss, also attended the session of foreign ministers of the EU, where actually we've been coordinating our next steps. And I think that's quite important, British Prime Minister talking to his colleagues in the EU. And this is exactly what we wanted from the beginning, that despite Brexit, I mean, we are first and foremost neighbors, partners, allies, and we should really put it in the proper perspective. But I'm also glad to say that we, of course, are permanently working together. We are talking to each other on technical level. We are in contact with Liz Truss. And what, of course, we want to achieve is to find the solution which would fulfill the mission which was there for the beginning, how to preserve the peace on the island of Ireland, how to avoid hard border. And we've been kind of crunching the numbers, going through different options. The offer we put on the table to make sure that we would reduce by, I would say, 80%+ all the procedures if it comes to the customs controls and SPS to make sure that it would create these so-called express lanes, so that most of the trucks will simply just, you know, be waved through and doesn't have to stop, because we can do a lot of these checks electronically.
Thank you very much, Mr. Vice President.
Ryan, thank you very much for your invitation. Thanks.
Wei Dong Lin produces this show. Our executive producer of audio is Jenny Arment. I'm Ryan Heath. Subscribe to this podcast on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever you listen. We'll be back next Wednesday with another episode of Global Insider.